tonight on Arena. Michael Fassbender on Kneecap, the movie, and working with the Belfast Trio. And we look at the career so far of Fontaines DC. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. Well, the film Kneecap continues to do great business in Irish cinemas, and this weekend it opens in Britain. The film tells the origin story of the rap trio Mowgli Bap, Makara and DJ Provy, how they met and started making music. And along with telling this story, the film also digs into the place of the Irish language in the north, set as it is against the backdrop of the political turmoil of the Language Act. Kneecap will be Ireland's entry for the Oscars next year. And of course, it features a lead performance from two-time Oscar nominee Michael Fassbender. He plays Arlo, the IRA man father of Nisha, also known as Mowgli Bap. Arlo is on the run, and in the film we see the devastation that this absence has brought onto his family. Earlier today I spoke to Michael Fassbender about his role in the film, but before we hear that exclusive interview, let's have a clip from the film.
Called our generation the ceasefire babies. As if our only defining feature was we were not the shit that came before us. Maybe they were right. Maybe we were only ever gonna be the moment after the moment. Just as fucked up and miserable as the last. Only with less chance of getting blown up to escape it all. But we still found ways to escape it all. You've heard of intergenerational trauma, right?
Right.
Our history?
Our history has become our biology. It's like the trauma our ancestors suffered.
Has inserted itself?
Has actually inserted itself into our genetic code. Post-traumatic stress disorder.
Psychological reverberations.
ADHD. ODD.
The troubles?
The troubles? I've got fucking troubles.
So, Michael, how did you come to play the part of Arlo in Kneecap? Did you know the band, or did you know anything about them, or was it the script drew you in?
It was my agent, Connor McCaughan, who said, look, a script has come in for you to play the dad of one of the guys in Kneecap. Have you heard of them? And I was like, no, I haven't. And then I went and Googled the band and then watched some of their music videos, and I immediately called him back and I said, let me take a look at the script. And then as soon as I read it, I was on board.
And when did you get to meet the band then, the trio?
I was doing some, I did a couple of Zoom calls with Nisha before I went over there. And JJ did a lot of my Gaelga recordings, so I also had a chat with him. But Liam, I believe I met first time when I got over there, when we were, you know, just before we started shooting.
Right. So DJ is Provy is JJ, and then of course Mowgli Bap is the Nisha who plays your son in the film.
Yes.
And like the amazing thing for us, because they're so good in this film, is that it was their first time acting. Now, that might have been different for you acting with them, was it?
No, it was never a worry for me that it was their first time, because as soon as I watched their music videos, I just knew these, you know, they were naturals. They had it. So They did a lot of like acting lessons and workshops and stuff, but that was never a concern for me. Once I saw their music videos, I was like, you know, these guys know how to do it. That's for sure.
So let's dig into the film. You played the character of Arlo, and he's an IRA man, well, a former IRA man. He's an absent father to Mowgli Bap, Nisha. And tell me about that character. How did you see Arlo?
Well, you know, that's the sort of, you know, the big thing for me with the character was, you know, him leaving his family at such a young age for Nisha, and the effect that that had on the household and his wife. And so, you know, that for me was, you know, the crux of my story. You know, somebody that is holding on to something that is, you know, in a lot of respects past, and the, you know, the damage that was done at home. And then trying to sort of write in some way that the relationship with his son and his wife.
Yes, and Arlo obviously believed very much in the cause. But in this film, because it's post-conflict, he has to come up against his son and his wife, who he was very absent in their lives, and the big hole it left in their lives.
Yeah, I think, you know, the thing is, for me, when looking at the character, it was somebody who had obviously, you know, dedicated his life to the cause, and then found it very difficult to not have that in his life anymore, because it was such an all-encompassing thing for him. And so he's very reticent to let go of that, for, I think, because he's scared about, you know, what will fill that void in his life. And, you know, the time has passed. His son has grown up. His wife he hasn't seen for I don't know how many years. So it's just about him really sort of coming to terms with that. And he's sort of forced into a reconciliation, really, with his son. But yeah, that's for me what the sort of crux of the character was.
It's a very political film about the Irish language, and the backdrop is obviously the Language Act in the north of 2022. How would you describe Arlo's position on the language?
I think that, you know, his whole position is, you know, to maintain and nurture, you know, the Irish culture and the Irish language being, you know, the main focus of that, to retain the language, to continue speaking it, and to spread the word as such.
In the film, it's full of irreverent jokes. It's an irreverent look at Northern Ireland. Your character, Arlo, who is now disguised as a yoga teacher, and the lads refer to him as Bobby Sandals. How ready do you think the audiences are for that kind of irreverence?
I think audiences are always ready for you know, irreverence when it comes from an authentic place. And that was the first thing that struck me about the band. You know, they're authentic, they're real. There's nothing contrived about them. And, you know, they're the voice of that generation post Good Friday Agreement about what it's like for them. And, you know, what they're making a commentary on everything that they grew up, that they were growing up around, and what it's like post that Good Friday Agreement. So, you know, anybody that knew the band before knows that's their kind of style. So, you know, I think as it shows, I mean, you know, the response has been amazing, not just in Ireland, but, you know, in the UK and in the States. You know, unfortunately, I couldn't make it to Sundance when everyone went out there. But, you know, I got texts from friends that were out there just saying, you know, oh, these kneecap boys are just taking over the festival. Everyone loves them. They've got such a sort of infectious sort of energy about them. And I have to say as well, you know, working with them, they were just all super professional. They're very bright, obviously funny. And very polite, actually.
Yes, and that irreverence about the different sides in the north is spread pretty equally, isn't it? I mean, everybody is in for a bit of a dig.
I think so, and I think, you know, for me, comedy is always a way to tackle difficult topics. You know, it's a way for us to actually sort of, you know, laugh in some respects to things that you wouldn't expect to laugh to, and therefore sort of break down barriers, start conversations. So I think comedy is a very powerful tool in that respect.
Now, you played Bobby Sands in Steve McQueen's Hunger. Do you see in any way these two pieces being in conversation with each other?
Not really. I mean, I never looked at it like that. I guess, in some respects, you think of, you know, like I said before, somebody who has sort of, you know, sacrificed their life for a cause. And in that, I mean, you know, their family and everything that goes with it. And what happens, you know, when there is a ceasefire and he's still out there, sort of, you know, lost in a lot of respects. So in, I suppose there could be a parallel there, you know, after the fact, but I never looked at the two projects really in tandem at all.
Yes, but you do have, you have always had a huge interest in the North, haven't you? You used to travel there as a child, even though you were brought up in Kerry.
Absolutely. You know, my mum's from Larne and Antrim, so all my, the all Irish side of my family are all from the North. And so, you know, all my cousins and aunts and uncles. So, yeah, we spent a lot of time up there.
And it must be wonderful for you to be doing a post-conflict film, having done Hunger and having, as a young person, experienced the troubles, even either from Kerry or in your trips up north.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, just the fact that it is a post-conflict now is such an amazing thing. You know, when we were traveling up in the 80s and it was sort of at the height of tensions there, it would have been hard to imagine, you know, peace. And so I think as well, if I could be as bold to say, you know, people, you know, in the North sort of experiencing it at the time, extraordinary things become ordinary. But it's only after the fact that you start to sort of see, you know, the way that people were living and had to live.
You're Irish. You do have Irish, presumably, having gone to school in Kerry and the wonderful Irish, Munster Irish that comes from Kerry. Was it hard to get your tongue around the Ulster Irish?
I felt a little bit ashamed, if truth be told, really, because about how sort of bad my Irish is, you know, having obviously studied it from the age of six or whenever to leaving certificate 18, but it started coming back to me. I mean, obviously, then I've got, you know, you're dealing with sort of, you know, the Belfast sort of accent version of Gaelic, and also, you know, it, in some respects, it's just very different pronunciations of the same word. So, I did have help. I had, like I say, JJ do the recordings for me, and then it was just about, you know, repetition and listening to it.
DJ Provy taught me Irish is kind of a badge you could have.
Absolutely. Although he's no longer officially a teacher, he remains to be a teacher.
Now you join me from filming, Michael. What are you filming at the moment?
I'm shooting something in London at the moment. It's a TV series. I'm actually on my way to work now. It's under, I think it's called The Agency right now. That's what it's called. And it's a spy series.
All right. And are you working on a film based on Kevin Barry's book, Night Boat to Tangier?
Yeah, we've been working on that for quite a few years. We bought the rights to the book some years ago and been working with Kevin closely about developing that script. And now it's just trying to find the right slot and time to actually shoot it. But huge fan of Kevin's work, and we were delighted to get the rights to the book.
Oh, that's very exciting news. Michael, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Kay.
I got a point to be proven to myself. Sitting too long, getting moldy on the shelf, cause I'm too far gone when it comes to mental health. Rather be sick in the head with a little bit of wealth. Time I tend to write a glotty cool estranger. My time can do yan and they need to sit down. I get relaxed when I get you recant. Never go live by your guest, take a show with my.
Shots to geek, to your doctrine, yeah, they're doing it to you constantly. An individual is surely what you want to be. You're born to sound good, live your fantasy. Before they eat you up, especially you're the lafagy. Fan sucker, BG for suckers, clean it off, flan mucker. They'll be pushbacks, but relax, sucker. Cause you're the real set, they heal it to us, brother.
It's the philosophy, me leg, I'm done, don't worry. Go live, I'm an ear, heal a pattern, TV Steve. need to be a fact for me, because Khabib wrote Tyler's follow years. So it's how it's meant to be. So got your cogger, clean out hands, now here's for him. Hagen shit, toss him over, Hagen toss and toss her. The future did the cost her, so talk shine, shine, score. New vision is faster.
I got a point to be proven to myself. Sitting too long, getting moody on the shelf. Cause I'm too far gone when it comes to mental health. But I'd be sick in the head with a little bit of wealth. I'm a tender, but I got a cool structure. My time can do young and deep, do sit down, sure. I get relaxed when I can shit be conscious. Then I go to pay a guest, I can show him I.
To the devil, let me be rich instead. He said,
you'll no longer be scampered, you'll be sick in the head. Nive two reels, just rajana. I'll go to be fibana. You want this for nagenas of rest when you're pissed?
Yes.
You're a mock. Akara.
Sound, I'll be back for a fat loan tomorrow. That's me never getting dressed. Depressed and always para. Throwing tantrums in my mansion, am I embarrassed?
Gark shots, go make it the bugger mirror. Kneel and dirt, my delong to Esmacara. Earth straight, insecure moment. Smoke on number, smoke until it's all done. All gone, no hard magic till it's all known. But we're making up our own laws. Never getting worried about our own flaws. A real job, we make our own bob. Kneecap, tree cap, we're our own gods.
I got a point to be proven to myself. Sitting too long, getting moody on the shelf. Cause I'm too far gone when it comes to mental health. But I'd be sick in the head with a little bit of wealth. I'm a gender, but I got a cool distance.
And that was Kneecap with Sick in the Head. And before that, you heard Michael Fassbender talking about his role in Kneecap, the role of Arlo. The film Kneecap is still on general release in Irish cinemas, and there are still some tickets available for Kneecap's upcoming gig in Vicar Street in October. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RT Arena or watch live on RTE/arena. Now, tonight it's time for our film reviews, Blink Twice, Cuckoo and Between the Temples. Zoe Kravitz is well known on the big and small screen for her star turns in The Batman and Big Little Lies. But now it's her turn to test her mettle behind the camera in the twisty horror thriller Blink Twice. In Cuckoo, starring Euphoria's Hunter Schafer, a young woman finds herself in the clutches of a bird-obsessed Dan Stevens, who really has moved on from Downton's Matthew Crawley and fully embraced his inner creep. And Jason Schwartzman is in his unhappy place in Between the Temples, playing a grief-ridden Jewish cantor who loses his singing voice but finds a friend when he reconnects with his childhood music teacher. Ruth Barton and Paul Whittington have been to the movies for Arena. We'll start with Blink Twice, Paul.
Yes.
Give us the setup here.
Well, this is Zoe Kravitz's directorial debut, and it is she's insisting it's not a horror film, but it's a horror film, which is apparent from very early on from the tone. The setup was reasonably nice. Naomi Ackie, who people will remember, played Whitney Houston in I Want to Dance with Somebody. She was very good in a not very good film. She plays Frida, who's this young woman with quite a chaotic lifestyle, who's waiting tables at this big exclusive social media event when she meets this kind of tech mogul, Slater Kings, played by Channing Tatum. And he is, we see that he's been in therapy because of some work-related incident which is not specified and which we can only imagine. But he seems ever so charming, ever so nice. And he invites her and her friend on a whim that night to his famous tropical island where everybody gets rid of their mobile phones and they kick back and they relax and they take very expensive drugs and drink expensive wine. He keeps asking her, "You're having a great time, right?" And she keeps answering yes, but she begins to suspect that she's not actually having a nice time.
Okay, so let's listen to a clip which just follows on from what you're saying. In this scene, Naomi Ackie as Frida gets the tour of the private island from its owner, the billionaire Slater King, played by Channing Tatum.
How good is that smell?
That's the area. It actually only grows here. We got a beautiful little herb garden over here. Got our chickens.
You know, it's not what I thought it was gonna be.
What do you mean?
The legendary parties of Slater King with drugs and debauchery.
We still do drugs. We just do them with intention. And we still have fun. It's just a little different now.
There's Channing Tatum and Naomi Ackie. So, Ruth, when does Frida, she's beginning to twig there that it's not quite what she expected. But when does she realise that something more weird is going on?
She realises this when her friend Jess, Jess was waiting tables with her, and they've gone to the island together, where they get mysteriously dressed up as sort of Vestal virgins, and they flap around the place in these white costumes. And Jess is rather more cynical than she is and is beginning to question the setup, and then suddenly Jess disappears. And what happens is then that Frida begins to get these sort of disconcerting flashbacks to some other reality on the island. And this all becomes kind of entwined with this mysterious native woman. I have to say, totally regressive depiction of native women, because she talks in gibberish and does strange things with snakes. And as a result of this, something is happening to Frida and to all the other women. And she begins to get these sort of visual flashes of the actual reality that's happening. Think Lost. Do you remember Lost, that TV series, when there's sort of multiple realities happening on an island? So there's another reality happening on this island. And so she begins to, so she starts to kind of slowly work out what's happening to her, what has happened to Jess, and what is happening to the other young women on the island.
Now, Paul, you said that Zoe Kravitz says this is not a horror film, whereas you say it is. And I mean, obviously, horror has been used to great effect in things like Get Out as a way of telling a deeper story, story about race and and racism not... there. Is that what she's getting at? She's getting at maybe misogyny and sexism.
Well, on the surface of it, she might be trying to get at that, and you could substitute the unpleasant misogynistic billionaire of your choice for Channing Tatum's character. But in fact, and it's even been suggested that the film has these kind of, you know, feminist undercurrents, but it does not at all. It's entirely bogus. It is shallow, wafer thin film that looks good for half an hour and does not deserve to be approaching the subject it's approaching.
Okay, you're nodding in agreement there, Ruth.
Oh yeah, I think it very cynically is hanging its hat on the Me Too movement, because it actually kind of stops and gives us a little lecture about how women are empowered by banding together. But in fact, when the women band together, without wanting to give too much away, in fact, it ends badly for most of them, and only the kind of two alpha women come out of this.
This is Frida and Jess, isn't it?
Yeah.
Jess has disappeared.
Someone else,
Frida and Sarah, she's this one-time has-been reality star. And so they come out as the sort of alpha women. In fact, hanging, you know, being sort of Me Too-ish together does them no good. And I just, to add to the cynicism, the production company has issued this trigger warning today, saying that you may be triggered by certain events that you see in the film. And again, I see that as totally cynically exploiting real-world trauma in order to promote a film.
Now, you would expect, Paul, that Zoe Kravitz would have a great little black book with people she could call on.
Yes,
and there are an awful lot of famous people here.
Yeah, there are. There's some great... I mean, they're largely wasted, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, Gina Davis is in it, and Christian Slater, who was totally wasted. Colin McLachlan is this kind of CD shrink. Simon Rex.
And are there star turns there? Is there humour in this?
Yeah, well, there kind of is humour in it early on. I mean, Christian Slater is always kind of funny, sometimes when he's not supposed to be. I think that Simon Rex, who plays the kind of chef, is actually very funny, because he's always funny. He's this histrionic guy who's obsessed with the sharpness of his knives, which bodes badly for the film's denouement. But I think she has an eye. She has a visual eye. There are some interesting things happening there. The colour palette's good and all that kind of stuff. But it's just vapid. The whole thing is vapid. It's meaningless.
All right. Stars out of five from you, Paul.
Generous two for me.
Oh my God. And from you, Ruth.
I share your generosity. It was two from me as
well. Two from you both. And that's from Blink Twice. So, Ruth, would you give us the setup for Cuckoo, another horror film?
Yeah, this is horror season. Who would have thought in August that our lives would be so disturbed by events around us? But it is also, well, we're actually about a month or two too late, but it was breeding season for the cuckoo. And that is what gives the film The Cuckoo its barely discernible plot. And although I'm sound like I'm being mean, this film is actually quite a lot of fun. It is a horror movie. It is so low budget that it barely hangs together. It is made by this German, sort of quite cult German director called Nathan Silver. It's his second feature. So it is. It takes place in the Bavarian Alps. It is a fairly conventional setup. This couple turn up at this remote resort. They're there with their with his daughter, her stepdaughter, who's just lost her mother, so there's trauma there. They have their own child, who's this slightly sort of blanked out preteen, and they are there ostensibly to because they're architects, to add a new wing to this remote resort.
And the teenager is Hunter Schafer, the people will know from Euphoria, for example.
Exactly, yes. That. And she's really, really good in this film. She's fantastic. But the star of the show is Herr Koenig. And Herr Koenig, who is Dan Stevens. And as you said, he's finding his weird inner self.
So this is Matthew Crawley, the people would
yeah,
know.
Yeah, this is like the war hero.
Who died far too soon in Downton Abbey.
Because he wanted to get out and do more fun stuff, I think. And so, and here he is. He's done a series of really weird roles, and I know weird is a word we're using a lot today.
Yes, and he is fluent in German and has has a whole other career of doing German films.
Yeah,
is that
he
right?
does. He does, and he, but he's a good actor. He's a very good comic actor, and he combines those in this. His Herr Koenig is a wonderfully unctuous creation. He's kind of simultaneously has this way of simultaneously complimenting and insulting people at the same time. You never know where you are with him. He's really creative. Creepy in a very interesting way, and he brings loads to a role that there's nothing in the writing, but he brings loads to the role.
And is he handsome Dan Stevens, or?
Well, he's always handsome Dan Stevens, isn't he? He can't be ugly Dan Stevens, but he is very funny. He's not afraid to seem ludicrous or to make fun of himself,
okay.
And he does so.
And you're listening to Thursday Night's Arena, and we're doing film reviews. We've just talked about Blink Twice, that our reviewers Ruth Barton and Paul Whittington have given 2 out of 5 to. And now we're on to Cuckoo. So Cuckoo is again a horror film made, as you said, by Tillman Singer, the director, German director, Ruth. Hunter Schafer then is extraordinary in Euphoria, and you say she's a real find and very good in this.
Oh, she's fantastic in this. She plays this, she's in every scene, something traumatic physically happens to her. So by the end of the movie, there's hardly a bone in her body that hasn't been broken. She's lacerated all over. And yet she's still determined to get to the truth.
So Koenig runs this centre and she's working as receptionist.
He gives her a job as a receptionist. But he says, you know, you've got to close up everything at 10. But of course she doesn't do what she's told because she's this 17-year-old. And she's also distraught at the death of her mother and leaves messages on her mother's answer phone, which literally comes back to haunt her. But she's also got this sort of slightly problematic relationship with her stepsister, who is played as the kind of classic horror movie creepy child. And the creepy child was a twin, and the twin...
I thought she was rather sweet, actually.
Oh, I thought she was super creepy. She was blanked out. She is also, it has to be said, mute. So she also deeply resents the stepsister, but is determined to save her, because somehow in the middle of this story, somewhere, it's really hard to follow the plot. Creepy Herr Koenig is trying to use them to breed more cuckoos. Follow that.
Cuckoos are a kind of subspecies.
I was wondering where this was all going.
A human subspecies who look like people but are in fact not people and make alarming noises. The reason you don't aren't following a case because they haven't bothered to work out the life cycle. It makes no sense whatsoever. I'm still confused about what it was. It sort of doesn't matter too much because there are some. I think he's trying to do something different. He uses the alpine setting really well. There's this great soundscape for the night. The forest is definitely dangerous. There's a fairy tale, German fairy tale aspect to it as well. And then there's Dan Stevens, who just is tremendous. The first time he meets Gretchen, he corrects her pronunciation of her own name. He goes Gretchen, and he keeps saying it. And he's so funny, but so insidious at the same time. And I think I went a long way with this film, despite the messy ending, because of what it was trying to do.
Oh, I'm dying to hear the stars. How many stars does it deserve now for being so sketchy, but yet so good in places, Ruth?
I gave it 3. I think, you know, it's not my cup of tea, but I thought it was such fun and weird and yet terrible at the same time that it hit the three for me.
Three and a half for me.
Oh,
I like a half star.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's yeah. Yeah.
That's too much.
Yeah, I think it's a bit sitting on the fence, but yeah.
Now, our final film this evening is the comedy Between the Temples. Jason Schwartzman plays Ben, a cantor whose wife has just died and whose singing voice has deserted him. Hope resides in a friendship he strikes up with his old music teacher, who cannot even remember him. So, Paul, we meet Ben in a dark place.
Yes, his wife, who was a writer and was also an alcoholic, died in this tragic accident, and he hasn't coped well. It's a year later, and he's moved in with his two mothers. He has two mothers, and I don't know what that's like. And he's retreated from the world. He can't sing anymore in the temple. So the rabbi is being very kind, trying to deal with this, but he's just not coping. And then things start to happen for him. He meets his former high school music teacher, the person who inspired him to become a singer in the first place, played by Carol Kane, who's great in the film as well, and she's in her 70s. And they
is
meet
this legendary Carol Kane?
No, it's the actress Carol Kane, who was in Annie Hall and things and people
yes,
like that.
Yes, but that kind of she's pretty
Princess
legendary.
Bride. Yeah,
she is. So I don't mean to say no, she's not a legend, but there is another.
Yeah,
but so he's drunk. She gives him a lift home, but she asks him a favor. She is Jewish in heritage, but she never did her bar mitzvah. And obviously, as most people will know, you're usually 13 or 14 when you do that, but she's 72, but she wants to do it anyway. Will he train her? And that's the kind of, in doing that, he's brought out of himself.
Now, we know Jason Schwartzman from Wes Anderson films, usually, but those kind of wonderful, weird situations he puts Schwartzman into. This is a different setup.
This is, because in the Wes Anderson films, he's one of a group of ensemble players who are dancing to the tune of Wes Anderson's.
Yeah, they're required to act in this very particular
stylized
way.
Kind of deadbeat.
Yeah, that's right. Now, this is his film, so he's at the heart of it, and he's paunchy. He constantly has a sort of a sort of zit on his face, and he's unhappy. His clothes don't seem to fit him right, and he is, you know, very, very de-glamorized and in the film. This is a Jewish comedy, and so it really plays to that whole tradition of Jewish comedies about being.
Indeed, he has two Jewish mothers instead of one, which piles it on. Yeah.
But one's a convert, but she says, "But my heart is in Jerusalem." She's very, very.
Oh, she's
good.
Gone full on, yeah.
Yeah, she really is. She's she was, if you remember Triangle of Sadness, she was the Filipina woman who who dominated them all in Triangle of Sadness.
Enough,
she's
yeah.
really good, and she's a convert anyway. This is kind of, but this is part of the film's actual richness, because it drops in all these characters, and what it's doing is it's playing with the rom-com as a form, because, you know, here you have this ill-assorted couple who should get together, but then the age differential is so huge, you think, well, they can't, you know, Hollywood doesn't, you know, the movies don't do this.
So there is a bubbling romance, is there, between
the music teacher, but then the Rabbi Bruce, who's a very funny character, he has a daughter who is just divorced. She's pretty, she's young, she enters the situation, he sort of becomes involved in her, but then he has this moment of clarity, which you are not expecting, and it's all very well done. And at the start of the film, I thought this is a bit of a mess for the first 10 minutes. But then it wasn't a mess. I figured out what he was trying to do. And the clever thing the film does is that it balances humor and pathos without perfectly, which is unusual.
And there are some really funny sequences in it.
Yeah.
Because Gabby is getting off literally on his dead wife's soft porn.
This is the rabbi's daughter. Yeah,
Gabby, the rabbi's daughter, who's as messed up as everybody else. She's getting off on his dead wife's soft porn novels. And so there is a sexual encounter in a cemetery where I was going to say comes to a head, but I won't actually say that.
No, we'll keep that one.
But anyway,
because you're going to behave.
Indeed. Yeah, we're keeping this one quiet. But it all happens in a car in the cemetery with these kind of flashes to his dead wife's gravestone. So these are really funny moments. That
yeah, and yet dark too, and there's sadness for a lot of the characters as well.
And what about the chemistry between Schwartzman and Kyle Caine?
Oh, they're just great together, because actually, even as characters at first, it just looks like it's not going to work, but their timing off each other is really, really good, and they're very touching together. You want the characters to succeed, which means that the drama is working.
So, as stars out of five for Between the Temples,
4 for me.
Yeah, I'm 4 too. I thought it's a movie for adults. You know, it's not a childlike movie.
No,
the other two are kind of childlike. This is for grown ups. This movie.
All right, but two fun films that you would recommend us go and see during the August
and a less fun film.
Avoid.
Paul Whittington and Ruth Barton. Thank you very much. Fontaine's DC fourth album, Romance, is among the most eagerly anticipated albums of the year. So before its arrival tomorrow, we thought we would invite Sinead Nivorda to track the meteoric rise of the band fronted by Grian Chatton. From their Mercury Prize-nominated debut album, Dogrel, in 2019, the Grammy-nominated A Hero's Death, and the chart-topping Skinty Fia. The band is comprised of Grian Chatton on lead vocals and tambourine, Carlos O'Connell on guitar and backing vocals, Conor Curley on guitar, piano and backing vocals, Conor Deegan III on bass guitar and backing vocals, and Tom Call on drums, percussion and guitar. Sinead, you're very welcome to
Thank
Arena.
You.
Now, you might take us back to their formative years. They met in college and came together because of a mutual love of poetry.
That's it, exactly. They met in BIM College in Francis Street in Libertines, something that they talk about a lot in their songs. And they formed about 2015, and they started getting together in 2017, going to a dirty rehearsal studio down in Lotts, the Lotts, North Lotts in Dublin One. And they just, they completely just married their love with poetry, with what they wanted to do with their sound and their music. They came from a background of really loving a lot of retro rock and roll sounds. And then they found themselves going out in different genres to the Garage Bar and Temple Bar, where Trev Dietz used to book a lot of the DJs there. So they had the likes of Robbie Brady, who'd been in the psycho punk band called The Things. He had Gav Icon. I used to DJ there myself as well. So they started discovering new music and the likes of Iggy Pop and Television and Count Five. And with every time they go into the studio, they come back having learned about new bands. And they're real ideologists, really. They wanted to try and break into something that was different, but also that was very much their own. So they really bonded over that kind of thing, new music, new ideas, and being really good friends. But they all met, it was back in BIM College.
Okay, let's listen to a track from their debut album, Dogrel. This is Boys in the Better Land.
Put the boys in the better land.
So that's Boys in the Better Land from Fontaine's DC. And I'm here with Sinead Nivorda, who has been looking back at Fontaine's DC career development. And the band is fronted by Grian Chatton, and his unique vocalisation that we heard there. It's really an unforgettable sound, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. It's one of the most distinctive aspects, I think, of the band's sound. And I love the fact that he sticks to that Dublin vernacular and really embodying that old school street poetry, I guess. That's where Dogrel, the album name, comes from. It's from Dogrel. It was a style of street poetry that was quite famous around the 1630s, I think it goes as far back as that.
And did it come naturally to use his own Dublin accent?
Yeah, it's something that he always wanted to do, I guess. You know, it was his... It was, I guess, a conscious decision, you know. Rather than singing that kind of mid-Atlantic kind of accent that a lot of bands kind of favour, it actually happened, it clicked with him, I guess, when he's on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean, when he was in New York. And when he came back to Dublin then, he just felt he was more attuned to the nuances of the sounds of Dublin, the characters of Dublin, the streets. And it's something he wanted to do since he was a kid. And it just used to jar with him a lot that people didn't seem singing their own accents, you know.
And it was in New York as well that the band signed for Partisan Records, which
they toured so much, really. So they self-released a lot of the early singles, like Liberty Bell. I think it was Trev, their manager, who pressed into my hands back in Harper and Class Heroes in 2017, which became Ireland Music Week. So they released a few double A singles, and then they eventually came to sign to Partisan Records, making them label mates with a slew of other incredible bands like Idols and Cigarettes After Sex. And then that brought them on tour to America, where they played with Idols, where I got to see them live at Brook on Steel, and it was amazing.
What were they like then?
Oh my God. You know, you've got this incredible, massive steel industrial venue in Brooklyn, and the capacity was about 1800, but the place was full from the start. There was as many people there for Fontaines as there were for Idols, and they just trashed it out, you know. I mean, with their sound on record, whilst they did record it live, when you actually see them live, it's a different kind of beast altogether. You know, they have that real brash, energetic, raucous, nervous intensity that really comes across, and delivered with Green as well, with that nervous, nearly like a guard dog, you know, the way he kind of embodies that incredible, almost Ian Curtis-like vibe. And in fact, he nearly feels so sick afterwards and nearly vomiting with it, just with the energy that it comes for him. Anyway, they were amazing at the Brooklyn Steel, and I queued up for half an hour for merch and did the whole thing.
He's a kind of naturally shy young guy who kind of transforms on stage.
That's it, because when he was in school, I guess he felt like a bit of a misfit, and I can relate to that in the sense that, you know, anything that wasn't English and music, he just didn't really kind of take to. And it wasn't until he went to BIM and he felt like his IQ kind of, I guess, went up, in a sense that he felt like he was at home, and at home with these people and his band members that came family to him. And then it's something that came so naturally, and he got just so passionate with songwriting. And he'd been writing since he was about 9 years old. His family were very musical. His dad was a musician, and even his mum got him out of bed one night when she got the Cure's Greatest Hits to dance around. So he was writing since he was nine, and then he fell in love with songwriting so.
That sounds so fantastic. Yeah. The parents and the son dancing to The Cure. Yeah. So let's listen. You were talking there about the band's lyrics form from features and motifs and characters from the landscape of Dublin. Mm. So, for example, Liberty Bell from their debut album, Dogrel Again. Let's listen to Liberty Bell.
Do about it. Is it easy just to try it? Is it the same old lie?
So that's Liberty Bell again from Fontaine's DC debut album, and that was Dogrel. The next album was A Hero's Death. So how had their sound developed from one album to the other, Sinead?
When they were recording this album, it was in the middle of their tours around America. They played about, I think, 9 shows in 5 days in South by Southwest, and they were trying to buy some time. And you could hear then that they were eager to check out of that whole post-punk revival and stepped into a bit of a moodier, more melodic territory. So they flirt with a bit of psychedelia a bit more. There's some echoey guitar. They embrace melodies in terms of harmonies with backing vocals. So, you know, stuff that would kind of also reflect the likes of Pill, the Stooges and Gang of Four. So they do have that, I guess, the backbone of that rumbling bass and frenetic energy of Dogrel. But then they kind of move on into a different, more of a melodic kind of sense, I guess, with playing around with guitar sounds and pedals and more studio work.
OK, so let's listen to a little of the title track from Hero's Death.
Always empty. Life ain't always empty. Life ain't always empty. Life ain't always empty. Life ain't always empty.
That's A Hero's Death from the album A Hero's Death from Fontaines DC. And Sinead Ní Vorda is with me looking at the career of Fontaines DC on the eve of the launch of their fourth album, which is called Romance. And we're looking forward to that. And of course, we'll be reviewing it in our album slot tomorrow. So move on then to the next one. This is their third album, and this is Skinty Fia. What does it mean again? Can you remember?
Yeah, so it refers to an old Irish saying that was often voiced by the great aunt of Tom Coll, who's the drummer in the band. So it translates to the damnation of the deer. So both the title and the cover art alludes to the extinct Irish elk, and also known as the giant deer. And that was to kind of, I guess, reflect their feelings of dislocation, both from their home country and any semblance of normality they experienced before, because they actually moved. They up sticks from Dublin over to London. And whilst, you know, it's just across the pond, everyone speaks English. Winglet, they just felt like they were quite misplaced. And it also, I guess, threw a shot, shone a spotlight on Green and their Irishness, and he was just more conscious of it. And he felt so, I guess, protective of it, you know, and he dreaded the idea of his accent softening. And he wore a lot more on his sleeve, and it comes across quite a lot, I guess, with this album.
And how big are they now?
How big are they now?
Yes.
I mean, four albums are in after 5 years? Like, they have achieved huge stardom. Like, they've had their faces emblazoned across the infamous lights of Times Square. They have been puffed at Gucci shows. They have reached number one in the charts, something that is so hard for a band to achieve, and especially an authentic rock and roll band like Fontaines, an independent band that's not aligned to the normal pop charts. They're achieving something that it's really hard to achieve in this digital age, with TikTok, and TikTok being the platform that exposes a lot of underground dance stuff. You know, they're achieving something that is nearly impossible to do in this modern age.
Now, we have heard some tracks from the new album, Romance. What are your thoughts? What are your expectations for tomorrow?
Oh my God, I'm so excited about this album. So, I mean, they've kind of stepped away a lot. They without tethering themselves to that original backbone of that punk raucousness of Doggerel, they've moved on to embrace pop and grunge and even, you know, cascading riffs and orchestra and strings. And it's just an opus of an album. And with each single, even that you've heard, from Starbuster to Favorite. It's a beautiful pop song. And how you can actually hear Green chat and actually sing now as well. And that was probably a lot down to Chaos of the Fly, his solo record that he managed to bring out, because for the first time he really noticed his voice and got to work on it and discovered a lot more. So what they brought out, Romance, is just...
Well, you're making us all excited about tomorrow. Let's have a listen to Romance, and we'll be listening to more of Fontaines D.C., obviously, when we review the album tomorrow. Well, of course, that was not the title track, Romance. That was Favourite from Romance. And that's a great track, isn't it, Sinead?
It's beautiful. It's such an early, straightforward pop tune, replete with beautiful backing vocals, or backing harmonies. But each track is so different. Like with Starbuster, you've heard the exhilarating trip hop. You've heard anthemic grunge pop from Here's the Thing. And then the strings and the orchestral grandeur of that incredible singer in the modern world. So the album Romance... absolute masterpiece.
Be Still Your Beating Heart. Well, yes. It's out tomorrow and we'll be reviewing it here on Arena. Sinead Ní Vorda, thank you so much for looking back at Fontaines DC. That's it for tonight's show. The show was researched by Paula Shields and Barbara Rose Sanwu. Mark McGraw was on sound. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator, and the programme was produced by Reg Luby. John Creedon is next.